Now, when we hear about deaths from COVID-19 in news reports, we get the latest numbers often and sometimes comparisons so we can better visualize the scope of what we're talking about.
This vaccine news comes alongside a dramatic increase in the number of deaths. We're now around 300,000 people dead in the United States alone. I'm troubled to even say this next sentence, but someone has put it on the page in front of me. 300,000 dead is like wiping out the city of Pittsburgh. And we're not done. How much worse could it get?
You know, this upward trend in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths that began.
That was NPR's Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep talking to health reporter Allison Aubrey earlier this week. How we talk about the numbers can have an impact on how we process them, and so can the daily grind of hearing about the rising number of people dying from the disease. How does this all factor into people's decision-making about whether to engage in safe or unsafe practices going forward? You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you hear the latest numbers when it comes to COVID around the state and around the country? Do you worry that people get numb to it at this point? How does seeing the numbers make you feel? Do you think it's effective how this information gets communicated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ellen Peters is a decision psychologist and the Philip H. Knight Chair and Director of the Center for Science Communication Research at the University of Oregon. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, what is your basic answer to the question of how do we convey these massive numbers that have stories behind them without making it everyday people get lost in them as statistics?
Yeah, so it's actually a really tough thing to do because our brains are not wired to make sense of these kind of big numbers. There's sort of two different ways that we understand numbers. One is kind of with our thinking minds, and these big numbers overwhelm our thinking minds. We tend to be what we call innumerate when it comes to, you know, lacking in numeric literacy when it comes to these big numbers. But they're also beyond the capacity of our intuitive minds. And so they're really tough things to do. So when you're communicating numbers, there are a variety of things that you can do. You can try to do those comparisons, whether it's to the number of people who died at Pearl Harbor or the number of the entire population of Pittsburgh. So you can go ahead and do that descriptively. You can also show graphics. You can show visual depictions, trying to help people get a sense of how large that number is when it's kind of beyond them. But then the other thing that you can do is also you can try to put the tears back on the statistics, which is kind of what you were just trying to do, Rob, when you were telling the story of Dwayne Burke and his father.
One of the goals here is probably to, whatever the situation, in this case, the pandemic, is to have people hear this information, see this information, and then act on it. In this case, wearing the mask when they're around people, socially distancing, not traveling, that kind of thing. For most people in the country, I think that is working, but not for everybody. How do you take this information and use it to translate into positive action?
Yeah, so you do want to present numbers in ways that people can understand, which is what I was kind of touching on a minute ago. But there's other stuff you have to do, too. So communicators, whether it's the incoming Biden administration or people in your or communicators in your own city, need to be sending out messages to people from trusted sources, because communications that come from people we trust are more persuasive. People are more likely to do what's asked or recommended when the message comes from somebody, when it comes from someone they trust. There are other things we need to do, too, though. We also have to figure out how to establish and maintain what are called social norms about following guidelines. We want to get the grand bulk of people getting vaccinated, wearing masks, socially distancing. And then we want to communicate that those social norms actually exist, because they can guide and direct behaviors. People conform to and do what other people are also doing. And so that's another sort of evidence-based communication technique that can be used. Other things are telling stories. That's, again, that goes back to your, the story of Dwayne Burke. And I suspect you've had lots of other stories, unfortunately, in your city and state to talk about, where again, you're kind of trying to put the tears back on the statistics. There's a variety of different things that you can do to get people to pay more attention to the importance of taking protective behaviors. Another thing is to focus on what people value. And oftentimes what we value is not just doing stuff for ourselves, but doing stuff for other people as well. And so, telling people, and I've told people this many times, I wear a mask because I don't want to accidentally infect somebody who's in a really vulnerable population. And so getting people to think about not just what their behavior does for themselves, but connecting it with other people that they care about. I had a student at one point, and I was actually surprised by this. He ended up testing positive for COVID, and he got really, really upset. And he wasn't upset because he was sick. He was upset because he had gone to his barber right after getting sick, and he was worried he might have infected him. And it made him feel terrible because he didn't want to infect somebody who he really cared about.
In the media, sometimes we focus on, well, with COVID, with the people pushing back on some of the guidelines, masks and things like that, even though they tend to be, according to surveys anyway, a small portion of the population, instead of focusing in the media on the fact that most people are observing these guidelines. Does that send a message to somebody watching about what's really happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So that connects directly back with the idea of social norms. Anytime we're communicating and trying to get people to do something, if most people are doing it, we want you to know that most people are doing it. If you focus on the few people who aren't, I remember early on in the pandemic, they were showing, the crowded beaches down in Florida. But most people actually were socially distancing and being responsible. And that's what you want to communicate. You want to communicate that the great bulk of people are doing what it takes to keep all of us safe, because we're going to conform to that. We're going to do what other people do. It's going to tell us, yeah, that's right. That is the right thing to do. And they can do it. And I can do that, too.
We're talking with decision psychologist Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon about how people are or are not processing the information that's out there about COVID deaths and cases. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has your response to hearing about COVID numbers, COVID deaths changed over time? Was there a moment that you remember this year where a switch was flipped and you realized, this is a big deal and it's going to affect our lives? What was that moment? What was that thing that changed your mind? Do you feel a fatigue as you see the numbers every day? Do you see other people thinking, giving up on following what's going on and just living their lives? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about how and whether we people can wrap our minds around the number of COVID deaths and cases being reported and how best to communicate information like that. Our guest is decision psychologist Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think back on your emotions since March when things around the country largely locked down as this thing, it was clear this was serious? What changed your behavior? If there's something that did at a certain point where you thought, wow, I guess I should wear a mask, make a mask for others to wear. What changed your behavior if you are involved in communicating risk about disease or anything? Love to hear how you try to accomplish that. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ellen, is there something uniquely challenging about a disease, especially a disease like COVID, that has this lag time between when it hits a community and when the numbers start showing up, and that a lot of times is in a different place and it's kind of invisible, and the people suffering for it, they're not doing it in plain sight, they're in a hospital somewhere?
Yeah, it's actually a really tough situation. It's tough because the disease is really abstract to a lot of people. A lot of people don't actually know anybody who've had it or who have had a bad case of it in any event. And so you end up with this situation where, one, the actual likelihood of infection is relatively low, but when it does occur, it spreads like wildfire. But it spreads like wildfire like 3, 4, 5 days later, and in kind of an unknown way, because sometimes most of the time, if you get sick from somebody, it doesn't look like they're sick, and as a result, what you're responding to is just the possibility of getting sick. Not that there's someone in front of you coughing, but that someone around you might be might be infected and they might be a super spreader, for example, and you could get it. And so you just simply need to protect yourself all the time without having any kind of sort of vivid demonstration of the disease that you can react to and say, oh yeah, that's right. I need to be doing this. I need to be staying safe and keeping other people around me safe.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jason is with us in Plover. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to say you were asking for, like, you know, the moment that, you know, people really became alarmed. And for me, it was when the NCAA canceled the March Madness tournament, because my brother went to Michigan State University, and he knows how much revenue the big sports bring into universities these days. And so when the NCAA was willing to part with all of that money that they make off the March Madness tournament, that's when I got concerned. I was like, wow, this is real. This is something to worry about.
So. Jason, thank you so much for sharing that. I had a similar thing. You know, I'd been talking about this on the air since late January, but the moment it really hit me was when the NBA, it was another basketball story, when they decided we're going to leave a lot of money on the table and shut down. Ellen, seeing a big institution like that take this really seriously, take what might appear a drastic step, is that something that helps communicate to people like me and Jason?
Yeah, it totally does. So that kind of thing is such a surprise where it just makes you stop and think, like, oh my gosh, what is it that's really going on here? And I think that's what happened to Jason, and I think that's probably what happened to you. You suddenly realize this is much bigger than I was counting on originally.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jason. We'll go to Laura now in New Berlin. Laura, hello.
Hi. I was saying that the turning point for me was when my daughter, who's a nurse and was working in a COVID ICU, called to inform me that she has a DNR put in place and that she's told that if she gets this, that they were not allowed to intubate her. And she said, I'm telling you because they will try to call you to, you know, change your mind, to get me to change my mind. And she was very upset because she just had a 35-year-old patient die. This was in early April. She had a 35-year-old patient with no pre-existing issues pass, you know, die from COVID.
Wow. Laura, thank you for sharing that DNR do not resuscitate order. The messages we've heard, Ellen, from those critical care workers, emergency room workers and others, how powerful can that be in communicating the seriousness of a situation like this?
They can be incredibly powerful. And first, Laura, thank your daughter from all of us. her job's incredible. Those kind of concrete, vivid, easy to imagine experiences, they convey in ways that little else can. Numbers can't convey it. Numbers are so abstract. And, you know, just hearing 300,000 people died or 290,000 people died, it's like it doesn't even sort of get past the filters in our brain to say that it's important. But you hear about someone like Laura's daughter and the experience that she heard and the fact that she herself is not willing to be resuscitated having watched that. And it just grabs you by the heartstrings. And those kind of emotional reactions are much of what drives our real reactions to risk. We rely on those kind of emotional reactions to tell us, what is it that's really dangerous out there for me and what should I do about it?
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon. She is a decision psychologist. We're talking about how best to communicate information about a serious threat, in this case, mainly our current pandemic. Brian joins us next in Sharon. Brian, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Brian?
Yes. I've been following on the conversation tonight, and I just wanted to kind of make a mention of what your question was, when did I first notice when the pandemic was serious. In my line of work, I'm actually a steel technician for a property maintenance company. And when the lockdown in Wisconsin occurred, it really struck me that very day that it almost seemed like apocalyptic, where the roads, which are normally quite busy in my daily routine, were empty. And my company that I work for, I go into residences all the time. And again, as I noticed that first day being out on the road where nobody was around, I really thought to myself, okay, PPE is going to be very, very important at this point moving forward. And Thankfully, by the luck of just being, you know, following the science and being very careful what I do every day, my daily routine, thankfully, I have maintained not getting infected at this point.
Brian, thank you so much. That rings a bell, I'm sure, for a lot of people. I remember walking in my neighborhood and that eerie silence. But Ellen, maybe that did, apart from the effect of the lockdown itself, that may have been a way to convey information about the seriousness of the situation.
Yeah, absolutely, Rob. Excuse me. What that kind of a cue is saying is that something's wrong and something is seriously wrong because those roads shouldn't be empty. I remember that exact same experience where I live and just being so surprised at how eerie it was that there was no one out on the road and having, you know, that little bit of like, oh my gosh, I should be afraid of this kind of experience. And so it gives you that kind of cue to experience an emotion that, again, you can use as information as you go forward about how risky this thing is. But it also, it goes back to what you were saying before, Rob, where you talked about this idea that, you know, it gives you a cue about what others are doing. And what others are doing is they're not going outside. They're not mixing and mingling. They're staying home and they're staying safe.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute, I worry, Ellen, you know, early on in COVID, I thought, well, you know, there was Ebola and we were worried about that. It didn't end up being a thing here. It's happened other times with diseases. And I, you know, just in my own job in broadcasting, I don't want to err on the side of over scaring people. Just can you take a few moments to talk about how we balance that?
Yeah. So, you know, we do use our, a lot of research tells us that we use our emotions to figure out what we, you know, what we should be, what we should be afraid of, what we should be avoiding. So, you know, you feel fear, for example, when you walk down a dark alley, and it's telling you, you know what, you need to be aware here. You need to be looking around, making sure you're safe. Maybe you shouldn't be in that dark alley at all. And so those kind of gut feelings are usually helpful. They sort of act as a GPS for us to help us figure out, well, which way should I go? But those gut feelings aren't always helpful. They can sometimes overwhelm us into panic. It can also mess with the filters we normally have for what's real news and what's fake news. But what ends up happening is this kind of a situation that's going on and on and on. You know, we've been on a global lockdown since mid-March, basically. We're not equipped to feel worse and worse and worse every day. Instead, what we tend to do is we adapt and we kind of numb ourselves to these kinds of ongoing stressors. And it's just so that we can be functional and go on with our lives. But people are really adaptive. There's even a theory, it's called opponent process theory. And what it says is that when you experience an emotion, like a negative emotion that a lot of your callers have been talking about, you experience that negative emotion, but then you more or less automatically experience a positive one. And so you can think about like roller coasters. They're really scary at first, and that's unpleasant. But over time, the opposing emotion kicks in, and it becomes kind of fun, and you remember it as enjoyable.
We'll have to leave it there. Maybe we can talk about this more again. Thanks to Ellen Peters from the University of Oregon, talking today about how we communicate risk in a serious situation like a pandemic.